Every donation is appreciated. Thank you for your support. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture, along with an archive of past shows. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammick and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about exciting concerts and events coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to previously aired shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House on Friday mornings, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7 a.m. right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
My name is Jeff Chang, and I'm co-author of this book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A Hip-Hop History, which my good friend and I, Davey D, wrote for young adult audiences. You might have heard that the book has been banned. It's true. The Department of Defense ruled that the book needed to be banned in all of its schools, 161 of them, serving 67,000 students, children of military parents on bases in the U.S. and around the world. Many of you have been asking us, how did this even come about? What's going on now? And what can we do? The bans came about because of this guy. America's least favorite drunkard. Earlier this year, they began pulling books from classrooms and libraries of military schools around the world. And they started with many of the titles that the far right has been trying to censor for years. But they also went after kids' books. They banned books like A Queer History of the United States, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and Asian American Histories of the United States. Starting to see a pattern? And because white supremacy is so freaking absurd, they even banned J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. But they didn't stop with the book bans. They told teachers that they needed to pull down posters of Martin Luther King Jr., of Malala, and Frida Kahlo. And then they banned celebration months, Black History Month, Asian American Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and Pride Month. When they found out that the AP psychology test included a whole curriculum on gender, they got rid of that as well. Found out that the kids were learning about immigration, they were reading President John F. Kennedy's book, A Nation of Immigrants, and they banned that as well. If you ever wondered what education would look like under fascism, the Trump administration, Pete Hegseth, and all the rest are showing you right now. On April 10th, students around the world on military bases from Okinawa to Kentucky walked out. But out of this, 12 students became plaintiffs in a case that the ACLU filed to stop the Department of Defense's ban of these books. This school year might be over, but next school year, we want students to be able to learn what they want to learn and for teachers to be able to teach what they must. Dave and I know why they wanted to ban Can't Stop, Won't Stop. It's because it's the story of hip-hop, the latest manifestation of Black freedom culture, which calls us all towards the America that we all want to be a part of. One that's open, that's inclusive, that's about the liberation of everyone. They don't want that. They don't want to see us unite because we're still the majority.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Over the past couple of weeks, we've talked about a number of things around censorship. And we had made it known that the book myself and Jeff Chang put out, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, the Young Adult Edition, was one of many books that was pulled by the Department of Defense in the schools and places that they have jurisdiction over. That came as a surprise to us because, I mean, it's a book about the history of hip-hop, and we thought we did a pretty good job in actually bringing people together. But nevertheless, it was part of the array of books that they deemed offensive. And it was just the latest salvo in a whole line of steps being taken by this current administration to ban books, to stifle speech, and to really punish anybody who seems to embrace the ideas of inclusion and diversity or has any sort of criticism about the current government and the way it's run. We wanted to talk to somebody who has his finger on the pulse. He's part of the ACLU. It's Emerson Sykes. He is a senior staff attorney that focuses on speech privacy and technology projects. He focuses on First Amendment free speech protections. And I can only imagine, Emerson, you must be busy. Because it seems like every time I wake up, there's a law being passed or proposed or some sort of action. So for me, it might seem like a big deal, but for you, it might be, man, take a number. There's a whole lot of other scenarios that are very similar to the ones that we've encountered.
Well, I can say thank you for having me. I am keeping busy. My team on the Speech Privacy and Technology Project is keeping busy, representing students and activists, including Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeysa Ozturk, and many others. But the whole ACLU is busy on the Alien Enemies Act, trying to make sure people aren't deported to foreign countries that they're not even from. We got folks litigating trans healthcare. We've got, everybody in the whole building is busy. So, we are, as our leadership reminds us, built for moments like these. We're ready for moments like these, but it is not an easy task.
Did you or your staff anticipate things to be the way that they are unfolding now?
We did have a, well, we you know, were very busy during the first Trump administration. We filed hundreds, maybe I don't even know the final count, the number of lawsuits that we filed against the Trump administration the first go around. We're obviously on pace to break that number, you know, probably this year. And so we did know going into inauguration, obviously after Trump won the election, we had begun our preparations for either a Biden second term or a Trump second term, you know, months before the general election. By the time the general election results came out, we were well on our way to having a plan for what to expect from the Trump administration. We spent the months in between the election and the inauguration ramping up those plans. He, you know, when Trump was a candidate, he was not shy about saying what he would do on day one. You know, we saw Project 2025. We saw his promises to, you know, stamp out DEI and all sorts of other things on day one. So we had a good birthright citizenship we knew was coming on day one. And so we, in some sense, had a pretty clear idea of what was coming, and we were able to respond, not just the ACLU, but many other organizations as well, were able to respond on day one. But that has not, it's also been full of surprises. I think we can, you know, we were quite well prepared. We spent a lot of time preparing. And at the same time, you know, part of the experience that not just we have, but I think, you know, everybody is having, is you wake up every morning and the question is, what on earth, what new crisis and chaos hath he wrought?
Right. It seems like the strategy on their side is to flood the plane, so to speak. Just have everything that you could possibly think of show up. And I think a lot of it is distraction. It's also a strategy to figure out which fire to put out. Do we put out the banned book fire? Do we put out the kidnapping fire? Do we put out, you know, the, you know, removal of diversity fire? And so it's hard to stay focused for a lot of people. And I guess sometimes it's the sensational things that we tend to hone in on. You know, for example, Elon Musk arguing with Trump seemed to capture everybody's fancy. But in the meantime, a whole lot of laws were, you know, being put through. Let's focus on the free speech aspect, because the ACLU has long been known for that. How do you define free speech? You know, and is there nuance to it as we're looking at some of the things unfolding now?
Well, yeah. I mean, the free speech is a very broad concept that encompasses a whole, you know, range of ideas around expression. As a litigator, as a constitutional litigator with the ACLU, I care a lot about free speech and the principles that underlie it. What I actually bring cases around, though, is the First Amendment. And the First Amendment protects free speech, but in a very specific way. And so this impacts my work. So I want to answer your question, which is about free speech, which is a big idea, but also be clear that the First Amendment is really about protecting private speech from government censorship. Private speech from government censorship. Now, private censorship of private speech is not implicated by the First Amendment. That's why when Twitter, or formerly known as Twitter, or any other social media platform that's privately held, they get to moderate content however they want without violating people's First Amendment rights as a general principle, because they're not the government. And when the government is speaking for itself, quote unquote, then there's no sort of private speaker involved. And so the government can say whatever it likes. But when the government as a regulator restricts what private people or organizations can say, then the First Amendment is implicated. And so that is where our sort of litigation focus. You were talking about the noise and the distractions and how do we stay focused. It's a huge challenge. But I think one of the ways that we narrowly focus you know, there's all sorts of things that are alarming and upsetting and deserve response, but only a narrow set of things that can be litigated in a constitutional forum, you know, and only a subset of those are going to be clear First Amendment violations. And so, you know, you're trying not to let too many important things go by. My colleagues are catching lots of the things that are going by, colleagues at other organizations. We got to trust everybody to sort of do their part. And you just make, and we're trying to do our best to make sure that within our areas of expertise. So I've been litigating around what can be taught and learned in schools for the last several years, since the first Trump administration, since their first attacks on critical race theory and inclusive education. And this new iteration around DEI is different. It raises different legal issues. The sort of book banning that we've seen in the Department of Defense is on a scale that I had not seen previously. So there are new things that are new, but at the same time, this is, you know, what we've been working on. These are issues that we know deeply. These are wins that we're building upon from earlier cases. And so I think it's a challenge every day, but I do think we can, you know, trust that if we do our part, others will do theirs.
Let's talk about the book banning situation. Sure. There's been many of them. I think the first time this showed up is when we started to hear about the proposal and eventual implementation in Texas around school books and how they were going to remove certain things about history and, you know, kind of sanitize the institution of slavery, blah, 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 right? So we heard about that, I want to say about 10 years ago. And then we saw a march to banning certain books. State of Florida was kind of leading the charge. Texas following suit, where my wife and her family are from. We're the actual educators. So, you know, so we kind of had an opportunity to get some first, you know, front row seats on that. And then it just started to, you know, explode when Trump came in for the second term. This situation with the Department of Defense that involved our book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, what is that about? And, you know, where does it sit in the realm of all these other kind of book banning things that are happening? And I'll just close with this. It seemed like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that some sort of precedent was being set. Well, if they can do this in Texas, then we can do it in Florida. And if they can do it in Florida, then we can take it a step further and start removing books from the library. And then we can tell universities they can't have this book. And then the next thing you know, you get the Department of Defense, you know, saying that they could do this, and boom, what's next? You know, what's going to be the next stop that in terms of book bannings?
I agree with you completely that it is sort of a progression that we can chart, especially over the last few years where I have been sort of deeply involved in trying to push back against these things. The only place I would sort of quibble is where we start the story. And I think there has long been a history of sort of, as long as there have been libraries, as long as there have been public schools, there has been a fight over what should and should not be taught in those places, what books can and cannot be taught, what ideas can and cannot be addressed, what debates can and cannot happen. So I think this is sort of a fundamental question that has always swirled around our public institutions, including our institutions of public learning. Now, that's not to say that this is not unprecedented in lots and lots of ways. The Supreme Court ruled on a school book, on its only case about a school library, in 1982, 43 years ago. So this has long been precedent. And, you know, what the Supreme Court said is, even in school libraries, where they're clearly, you know, public schools, they're run by the government, they purchase the books with public funds, it's, you know, entirely a governmental entity in every way, but it's a library. And you're not supposed to curate the library and remove books to suppress ideas, because that is, in some sense, government censorship of private speech, right? If the government is going to go through its libraries, not to decide what's educationally valuable, what's scientifically accurate, what's age appropriate, but for the specific purpose of eliminating ideas it finds distasteful, that kind of censorship, the Supreme Court has said, violates students' First Amendment rights.
And so this was the case in 83 or 82.
Yes, PICO v. the Board of Education of Island Trees. It was a case out of New York, Long Island, New York. It was a ACLU case. And since then, there have been many, many instances where schools have tried to remove lessons from the curriculum, remove books from the library, and students have brought First Amendment claims. Some have been successful, some have been not successful on different grounds, but this has been a long sort of contentious area. What we tended to see in prior years were a handful of books. And usually it was sort of around some sort of explicit material, age appropriateness, some allegation that there was obscene or vulgar or some sort of, you know, age inappropriate material. And the fight was over whether, you know, a 250-page book should be removed over one scene on one page in one book, something like that.
Right.
And the courts have a hard time sort of navigating getting into that level of the decision-making of the librarian. But what they look for is, was this sort of a viewpoint-neutral assessment of literary value, or was this censorship based on sort of religious bias or something like that? And so what we have here is a fundamentally different situation where we're not quibbling over whether the book was removed or why the book was removed or whether the books are inappropriate, age appropriate or explicit or vulgar or, you know, any of these things. None of that is on the table. The president issued executive orders banning gender ideology, quote, discriminatory equity ideology, his sort of rebranding of DEI, and a variety of other related concepts that are now prohibited ideas. The Department of Defense followed up those executive orders with guidance saying, scrub the curriculum, scrub the libraries of anything that might in any way be related, potentially, to gender ideology or discriminatory equity ideology or any other related concepts in these executive orders. And because these are federally run public schools, they're normal public schools. They serve military families, they're public schools, but instead of being run by the state or local government, they're run by the federal government. Hmm. And so Pete Hegseth is in some sense, you know, in charge of the school district. And so they immediately began removing books from schools around the world, including, as you know, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And they weren't removing these books because, as I said, for any of these other sort of legitimate reasons that libraries might, you know, review their collections on a regular basis. Instead, they pulled hundreds of books pending review before they even have made an assessment. Anything that looks, smells, seems like it might have something to do. They did keyword searches and just pulled books from circulation because they may in some way be related to these prohibited ideas. And this, on the scale that has happened, over five, they admitted in court that they have pulled 555 books and 41 curricular materials. That's even higher than the number that we thought. And they just filed another thing last night saying their number's up to 596.
And so they didn't give a rhyme or reason. And definitely from what we've seen, it doesn't make sense. You know, I can just speak on our book. If we look at it, it's a book that is actually very inclusive. We have a large section on white folks involved in hip hop. It's a history book at its core. I think we've included everybody that you could possibly think of. What's, you know, Latinos in hip hop, women, you know, we centered women in hip hop, and we gave those histories. So if one was to sit up there and go, well, you know, this is DEI, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, well, we have these two sections on white folks in hip hop. What are you talking about? And, you know, and we had everybody in the rainbow on there, and it's a history book. The question becomes, what would be the problem? You know, we've looked at it from a conservative angle. We talked about it from a progressive and liberal angle. So you had ideologies all put there because we were trying to tell a story. Now, that's just our book. But I was always curious when we looked at it. It's like, well, why would you pull this? What would be the criteria? What would be the excuse for it? Unless you just don't like a particular genre of music, but then you're hanging out with Kanye and Kid Rock and a bunch of other people who have the hip hop banner, you know, around their name. So you can't be a genre thing, you know, because we even have Kid Rock and Kanye in the book. So we even talk about Kanye going to see Donald Trump in the book. So it's curious to me as to what would be the excuse other than maybe it's, you know, Black and Asian folks in this case who wrote the book and is very popular in those communities.
Well, I agree with everything you said, including your conclusion in that last sentence.
Mm. Is that it? It's because of the authors.
They're screening, as I said, I can't emphasize this enough. They are screening to the extent that first they yanked the books on a keyword search.
Right.
Seemingly, yes, by author and topic, vaguely. I don't think they looked to see if you included any white rappers or any conservative rappers. I think they didn't look that closely, is my suspicion, at least before they pulled it.
Right.
Now they claim they're doing a more detailed review, but not for quality or inclusivity or any of these things, but for potentially touching upon any of the potential, the ideas that the Trump administration is trying to prohibit. And so that includes a broad range of things, including questioning conventional wisdom, including questioning American history, including questioning American institutions. I think there's all sorts of, you know, I agree with you and I applaud you for all of the ways that you were conscientious and inclusive in your book. But I think it shows that the censors are not as careful as you might hope. And they will come for us if we're not diligent.
Well, I bring it up, and this is not, you know, not so much to promote our book or anything like that, but it says to me that if you are willing to remove things that in many ways actually, you know, put you at the seat of the table, then there's something else going on, right? That maybe it's just like, I have my own personal list of material that I want to impose on everybody in the U.S., you know, and it might be 10 books that they think that we all should be required to read, that we got to enshrine it in law, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't matter if you did everything perfect in terms of satisfying any concerns they had. We have a bigger, you know, agenda afoot.
I mean, listen, it seems to me, and I don't think this is true of the teachers. I don't think this is true of the librarians. I don't think this is true of the principals or even the directors of these programs. But what I think is true of the president and of the Secretary of Defense and of the Secretary of Education is that they would like to see a whitewashed history that does not celebrate in any way anything other than their culture, their religion, their people. And that it's not a matter of whether you also acknowledge white people. They are banning books about female scientists because it potentially violates a ban on gender ideology, even centering girls in math or in science is seen as suspicious. So it is not about any sort of radical targeting, some sort of radical indoctrination or radical ideology. Any acknowledgement or recognition of identity is being made suspect, except white, heteronormative, Christian identities.
Emerson Sykes is our guest from the ACLU, staff attorney from the ACLU. When you've gone to court, what has been the response, and in particular, the response in this day and age where the government is doing what it's doing? How has the court looked at this? Has it been favorable? Are they questioning? Are they saying, well, let's reconsider? Or are they maybe saying, well, let's give the military some extra room to maybe have some control over what books are in the library under the auspices of national security or something crazy like that? That's what it seems like. New rules are being written, or they're just going to ignore any sort of ruling.
So a few answers. In my cases in general, and then in this specific case around the DOD school. So the kinds of responses that we have seen in these cases has been mixed. We've won a lot of these cases, right? Where they tried to ban specific ideas in public higher education in Florida, we got the Stop Woke Act enjoined as to higher education. So we have had some big wins. There was a law in New Hampshire similarly banning specific divisive concepts.
Wait, and so you're one of those cases in Florida?
Yes. And we want, and for higher education, yes. Look, there's a lot of other things going on in Florida. The law is still in effect in K-12. So I don't mean to sort of say everything's fine in Florida, but okay. We did win a very important First Amendment case and vagueness case protecting academic freedom in higher education in Florida against an attempt to ban certain ideas. And that case is now on appeal in the 11th Circuit. We also won in blocking the implementation of a law in New Hampshire. Similarly, that case is also on appeal. In Oklahoma, we sort of got a limited injunction. But what's interesting is that in Oklahoma, what the government said was basically, what they're arguing is basically, oh no, all we're doing is banning really bad stuff, right? Like, we're not trying to do any of the things that the ACLU and these teachers are saying we're going to ban, where you can teach about history, you can teach about hip hop, you can teach about all these things. You just can't be a radical leftist indoctrinator like so-and-so. And they, you know, so hold up a really embarrassing example and say, you know, this is happening everywhere and we've got to fight back. So there has been sort of a, it's not as bad as they say. We're just trying to protect children from the worst excesses of the left. That's one sort of defense. What Florida has said, and is there is no limit on our authority to regulate speech within our public colleges and universities, which is quite extraordinary. So they're not saying, oh, they're overblowing it, it's not such a big deal. They're saying, no, there are no limits on our power to regulate speech.
Wow.
In public colleges and universities. There's no such thing as academic freedom, because if it's our college and university, then Governor DeSantis gets to tell them what they can teach and what they can't teach. And they are entirely under the political control of the state administration. Now, that's their argument. So far they've lost, but that is their argument. You ask sort of, what is the government arguing and have they been successful? So far, that extreme position has not been successful.
Emerson, let me ask you this. Is this an attempt to maybe frame it as states' rights? Like each state, based upon its culture and history and blah, 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 should have a right to be able to regulate? Is that what they're trying to aim for?
Yes. And, you know, we have seen in other book cases, we have seen some success. We've seen some bad rulings. We've seen some cases that are up on appeal. We've seen states write what are called amicus briefs saying, like, this is, each state must have the authority to make these kinds of decisions. The courts should not step in. Let me come to what the government is arguing in this particular book ban case in the DOD, because we have had one here. The government has similarly said that there's no limit on their authority to not just buy books, but also eliminate books for whatever reasons they deem appropriate, especially to comply with directives from the commander-in-chief. What the judge, they said, you know, we have removed 555 books and 41 curriculum materials. They admitted that before the hearing. What they haven't said is, what are those books? And we have some sense because we've seen leaked lists from different locations. We haven't seen the complete list. The judge was very disturbed, it seemed, by this idea and ordered the government, before she could make her ruling she ordered the government within 7 days to share its list of 555 books and 41 curriculum materials.
Right. Wow.
And we said, great, like, we don't actually need the list in order to win, but we'd be very interested in seeing it, especially because books that we have every reason to believe are on the list, that our clients want to read, that they have tried to check out, they have not been able to check out. And what the government has represented is, oh, those books aren't on the list, they're just checked out. They were overdue. So now it'll be very interesting to see if those books are actually on this list, if they actually end up producing it. But what they've just filed yesterday is that they're now refusing to produce the list. They both are refusing the government, asking the judge to reconsider her request for their books. They have said they are under no obligation to produce such a list. And by the way, the list is now 596 books.
Wow. From your estimation, are there particular patterns that show up in terms of who's being red flagged, who's being banned? Is it mostly women? Is it mostly books that center on, say, gender identity? You know, how have you seen it over the years? And is there even a pattern in what you've been able to assess from this latest thing with the Department of Justice?
Yes, absolutely. There are patterns. I mean, as I said, many of the previous book bans were along sort of religious grounds. And so it was often books involving romantic or sexual or any sort of, you know, physical content, especially around LGBTQ ish characters. That has only intensified, and LGBTQ titles are prevalently featured on almost all of these lists. So right. That is certainly a theme. Books like Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be Anti-Racist, have also been prominently featured. Many texts about anti-racism and social justice have been prominently featured. But as you noted, many books that are not even explicitly political, but just deal with the lives and histories of people of color and women, centering these stories, even in a non-ideological way, even those have come under fire, especially on these much longer lists. And so when you're talking about banning 596 now books, certainly there are themes, but there's going to be some really wacky ones in there too.
You know, I know your time is short, so I'm going to wrap up. Emerson Sykes, we've been talking with. One, I want you to let our listeners know what they should and can be doing to push back and move things in another direction. And my last question has to do with the type of legislation that's been making its way through the courts, most recently in New York, with the defining of anti-Semitism and the type of words that you can and can't use. If you say to the river, to the sea, that's against the law. If you say free Palestine, that's against the law. These types of things, which seem to have found some favorable ground, even in places where we're at. You know, we have these proposals for these types of things that you can and can't say specifically. around Israel. I bring this up because if that somehow, if those laws manage to get on the book, does that set a precedent to say, well, look, we're able to, in the interest of protecting, you know, particular groups of people, et cetera, these are on the books as law. Therefore, we can now start to look at these books and find ways in which they feel that they're transgressive, maybe not towards Israel, but in other ways. And then, you know, you wrote something bad about the police. You know, we need to protect them. You said something about the army. And when they go, well, this is free speech. Well, look, we've already had laws on the books that say you can't talk bad about a particular country or its people, et cetera, et cetera. And I find that to be very ironic because some of the very same people who have been championing this, I've seen them in places like Berkeley holding up signs and saying, hate speech is free speech. So they've been advocating like they can call me and you the N-word and things like that. But God forbid if you go down the road and say something bad about governments and et cetera, et cetera. So you're the lawyer, so I don't know if that makes sense, if that comes into play. Just in my mind, it just seems like something that, you know, lays a path.
Yes. I mean, look, almost everyone is inconsistent about free speech, right? Everyone likes free speech for themselves, and everybody has a certain issue, whatever it may be, that they would rather not hear anyone talk about in a way that displeases them. And right. I think, you know, the issue around specifically the definition of anti-Semitism, something that ACLU has worked long about. And I think it's a specific example. Basically, what you're talking about is it defines, well, the definition comes from, was never meant to be law. It was a guideline. It was a sociological tool, right? A tool of analysis. It was never meant to be codified as a regulation and prohibit certain kinds of speech, even by the folks who created this definition. That's one point. But right. It says one indication of anti-Semitism could be criticism of Israel. The problem is, if that's then codified into law as a definition of anti-Semitism, as you pointed out, it makes any criticism of Israel potentially punishable as anti-Semitism. And that is hugely problematic. And I think it shows that even when the government has a reasonable or important or legitimate or even noble goal, like preventing anti-Semitism, like preventing racism, like preventing sexism, like preventing all sorts of discrimination, that we want the government to be actively helping to prevent, when the government tries to prevent speech in order to achieve those goals, even when they're good goals, that's when the ACLU, whether we sort of agree with the ones in power or not, we step in and say, listen, whatever your policy goals might be, you're going too far when you regulate what ideas people can hold and what ideas they can communicate.
Right.
And so prohibiting discrimination, prohibiting conduct that discriminates on the basis of identity, that discriminates on the basis of race, is important. But we have to be very careful when we're regulating speech, even hateful speech, even speech we don't like, even speech that is advocating conduct that would be unlawful.
So does that tie in? I mean, I just saw a speech with Eric Adams, you know, adapting and saying we're going to enshrine into law the IRH, I forget the definition, the acronyms. But basically, when I see that, or I see proposals by our own legislature here, if they get enshrined in law, does that set a precedent to then ban particular books? You know, even if it has nothing to do with the topic at hand, but it now says, look, we've been able to regulate over here, why can't we regulate over there?
Yeah, I mean, then there'll be an official definition of racism, not just about racial discrimination on the basis of race, but potentially indicating ideas that may underlie sort of, if you think about the sociological research that you and others have done about the different iterations that racism can have, and
right.
then if you think about taking all those definitions of all the different formulations of racism and then trying to codify that into an idea that is unlawful, and any hint of it might be criminally suspect, you know, who knows? Everything's on the table at that point.
Right.
And so I think you're right that it is a slippery slope problem, not just for speech about this topic, but for all kinds of ideas.
Emerson Sykes, what can our listeners do? How can they help the ACLU? What can they do about this case?
Well, you know, I work on the national level. I work in federal courts, and there's lots to be done, you know, there. But I think one thing I'm always suggesting to folks is to start local. There are, of course, ACLU affiliates in all 50 states. There's three in California and Puerto Rico and DC. And so there's and lots of other great organizations that are helping to organize folks. And I think in your community, in your schools, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, looking out for folks, keeping an eye out for creeping authoritarianism, keeping it. And because even, you know, I live in Brooklyn, New York. My kids go to amazingly diverse public school. And even there, with leadership that's deeply committed to inclusive education, we have shown that we need to, you know, stand up and protect what we think is important in our kids' schools, even in a neighborhood like that. So there's always, I think, something that we can do close at hand to stand up for what we believe is going to be in the best interest of our kids and of our country.
Emerson Sykes, staff attorney for the ACLU. Thank you, and thank the ACLU for the work that you're doing. You know, thanks for fighting on our behalf in this particular case of banned books. And hopefully we're able to turn a corner and get back to some sense of normalcy, and at least allow the free exchange of ideas, whether we agree with them or not. So we appreciate you. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be
Thank
right
you
back.
Very much. I appreciate it.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Chaos in California. Look at what you see in California. What is unmistakable is the aura of chaos. And I speak not here about the demonstrators. They are, in large part, reacting to government intrusion into their lives, the kidnapping of children, of old ladies, of gardeners, of really poor working people trying to build a life in the richest country in the world. So where does that chaos come from? It comes from some of the richest people in the world. It comes from billionaires. It comes from Donald J. Trump. And you think only Elon Musk wants to rule the world? No. It is characteristic of billionaires to want to control everything around them. Because essentially, they're insecure about losing that which gives them and their lives distinction. And that's money. That's property. That's wealth. And this is wealth at war with the poor. And some of the poorest people, not just in California, but in the United States entire. And these are people who just want to find a way to feed their families, their children, and build a life in the richest empire in the world. And it's also about divide and conquer, because that, at its base, is the essence of politics. Not addition, division, destruction, divide, fear. Those are the notes and registers of this moment. And only protest, cohesion, unity, care, and love can defeat this chaos. May it be so. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
God knows I am
reincarnated. I'm a stargazer. Life goes on. I need all my babies.
Woke up looking for the broccoli. High key, keep a horn on me. That could my seat. IP ownership. The blueprint is by me. Mr. Get off. I get off at my feet.
Couldn't try me in a tri-state. Buddy pass, but I get him splashed till he hydrated. Bounce out, know he spook town, eyes dilated. I got the money and the power, both gyrating. I feel good, get the f*** out my thighs. Look good, but she don't got no ties. I walk in, walk out with the size. Man, don't let me know what the price. What the f***? I got hits, I got bucks, I got new paper cuts. I got friends, I got foes, but they all sitting ducks. Hit his turf and get cracking, double back like a deluxe. 50 deep, but it ain't deep enough. Complete, there you go, beat him up. Falling from a money tree, and it grew throughout the month. Spit a loogie at the camera, speed off, yeah, it's us. I feel good, get the f*** out my thighs. Look good, but she don't got no ties. I walk in, walk out with the size. Man, don't let me know what the price. Squabble up, 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 squabble up.
Hold up, where are you from? I'm finna go dumb. Sideways. Bump stunk. Fever. I'm on one.
Thunk, 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 thunk. Baby rockin' it. Quid pro quo, what you want, cause I'm watching it. Broke on the flow, let me know if you clockin' it. Brody won't go, but I know that he poppin' it. It was worth tickets on sale till I silenced it. Pipe down, young, these some hoe with the politics. With him and some in him, that's a lot of. Don't hit him, he got kids with him, my apologies. Ghetto child, here was Blackie Miles with the smearing off. He high, we outside, Roddy about to kill him off. Blaps on blaps, it's a fact, this a brick or all. Tell me why the you rap, if it's fictional. Tell me why the you fed, if you criminal. Hey, Dot, can I get a drop? I'm like, nah. Hey, Boom Coon from the west side to Senegal. It's a full moon, let the wolves out, I've been a dog. I feel good, get the f*** out my thighs. Look good, but she don't got no ties. I walk in, walk out with the size. Man, don't let me know what the price. Squabble up, 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 squabble up.
Been falling. It's not safe for us in here. We're heeding the calling. I will not live in fear. But where do we go? What system is this? I'm letting Josh show me. We'll be right back.
it again. This weight is heavy like stones, and they won't break your back. We got to push on. We know this ain't right, and we carry on. We bind our freedom for flight. Our ideas are Babylon. But there's a
down at Hard Knock Radio. Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up. Ensemble Big Nine Wolves.
Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till it ready from the steel grade beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I lay with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go, hey, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Siempre con temas de actualidad. Escúchalo a través de KBOO 90.7 FM.
This is Bird Note. If you see a wild bird with a small metal band around its leg, that means researchers have given the bird a unique ID to keep track of it over the course of its life. Only bird banders with a permit are allowed to catch and band birds. Each species gets a band that's just the right size for its legs, from tiny hummingbirds to massive swans. If you see a banded bird, you can try and read off the serial code on the band with binoculars or a zoom lens. Then you can report the sighting to the Bird Banding Laboratory, a part of the U.S. Geological Survey that studies banded birds across the continent. The lab has amassed tens of millions of banding records over the years. Analyzing where and when banded birds are seen helps biologists figure out bird lifespans, migratory routes, and how their populations are changing. And that, in turn, can improve conservation efforts. Banding Records helped raise the alarm about declines in bald eagle populations due to the pesticide DDT. To learn more about bird banding, visit birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote is provided by Jim and Birta Falconer from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.